Now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
A perfectly good brain wasted.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura and Santa Barbara Counties. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is all media, all the time. We're going to delve into the media in all of its forms. My next guest is the travel editor for CBS News. Previously, he was the travel editor for NBC and ABC. He produces and hosts the Royal Tour series for the Travel Channel, and we're going to look deeply into the travel industry. As always, if you're interested and want to call in, you can call us at 639-0008. Peter Greenberg is America's most recognized, honored, and respected frontline travel news journalist. Peter is the travel editor for CBS News, and he appears on The Early Show, The Evening News with Katie Couric, and many other CBS broadcast platforms. He's the consummate insider when it comes to reporting the travel business and news. Peter's an Emmy Award-winning investigative reporter and producer. He was named one of the most influential people by Travel Weekly, along with Bill Marriott, Richard Branson, which I get, and Al Gore. We're going to ask him about that. Peter is the host of the nationally syndicated Peter Greenberg Worldwide Radio Show, which is broadcast each week from different remote locations around the world, and it's heard on over 400 stations around the United States. Welcome, Peter. How are you today?
Happy to be with you. It sounds like I can't hold a job.
Well, it does sound that way, but no, on the other hand, it does make you an industry expert, and that's the reason that I brought you here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. So thank you so much for being my guest. And let's start out by just sort of taking a look at the travel industry from 30,000 feet. All right, I know that travel industry is comprised of many parts, so the airlines, the hotels and the resorts, the cruise ships, the casinos and gaming, et cetera. But in general, what is the health of the travel industry following the recession of 2007 to 2009?
Well, actually, take the recession even out of the picture, because travel remains the largest industry in the world. It employs the most number of people, creates the most number of jobs, and perhaps the most significant statistic is that it actually creates or provides about 10.2% of global GDP, which is staggering. And the one thing that we've noticed, at least in this country, and in fact that you'll see it rippling across the world, is that travel is part of our cultural DNA. We have to travel. We need to travel. We want to travel. So you mentioned the word recession. Well, let's talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the middle of the recession, people might deny themselves a new pair of shoes, a night on the town, a new article of clothing, but they were not going to deny themselves the opportunity to travel. The only thing that changed during the recession is not that people didn't travel. They traveled for fewer days. So they went to Paris, but they didn't go for 10 days. Maybe they went for 5. But they still traveled, and now travel is the first industry that's really coming back with a vengeance as the economy starts to rebuild.
And that is true. We see that reflected in the reports of the earnings from the hotel chains, from the casino chains. But I want to come back to what you said. I agree that people enjoy traveling, and now that we have jet planes and travel has become very, very easy to do, we do more of it. But business travel is a big component of travel and obviously affects airlines, hotels, everything right on down the line. Business travel contracted during the recession, didn't it, Peter?
Well, it contracted during the recession because it was sort of like the AIG syndrome, especially in meetings and conventions. You know, nobody wanted to get a pedicure while Rome was burning. And so a lot of locations like Las Vegas and other convention destinations took a big hit. But the bottom line is business runs on travel. The sales teams need to get out there and sell their products, whether they're widgets or anything else. And so all you needed was like one Fortune 500 company to say, this is ridiculous, let's get our sales team back out on the road, and then everybody followed suit. So what you're seeing is business travel coming back in 4%, 5%, and 6% increments, and that's also significant.
It is, and we're glad to see that the travel industry is coming back. Obviously, here in Ventura County, we're very dependent on travel for both Ventura and Santa Barbara counties, so it's very important to us. Peter, I'm going to change directions with you for just a minute and talk about the airline industry. You've done some wonderful investigative work on the airline industry. Notably, you did a great segment on American Airlines, but the airline industry has always been an enigma to me. I mean, if you look at the commercial airline industry's profits from the beginning of time, from the 1930s when there was commercial airlines to now, it has never been profitable. Yes, there have been good years, but there have been bad years, and they've always offset each other so that the airlines have never really made a profit. Why do you think that is?
Well, because the business model stinks. I mean, if you really want to look at the numbers, the airlines have not made back their capital investment since the Wright brothers, and that's not an exaggeration. That's a fact. And the way the airlines are structured, everybody around the airline business makes money. The guys who make the tires, the engines, the guys who make the seats, the employees, the guys who make the carpet, the guys who fuel the planes. Everybody makes money except the airline. Now that's going to start to change because as you've noticed in the last maybe 3 years, we're seeing a ramping up of consolidation, and you're getting fewer and fewer airlines, and those airlines are actually filling more and more of their seats because of the law of supply and demand. So what you're seeing is right now the airlines are filling on average of about 87% of their seats, which means effectively they're flying full. And you're seeing an intersection of that increased demand that we just talked about and a decrease in capacity. So if the airlines don't overexpand and get crazy, they can actually make a lot of money. In the last year and a half, they've been making a whole lot of money.
Well, that brings up an interesting point because the most recent merger was United Continental. That's in the United States. That was the most recent merger. And I'd still contend, or I'd ask you as the expert, are there too many airlines serving the United States today?
Oh, listen, you'll never see me saying we should have fewer airlines. I like a lot of airlines because it allows for increased competition, better deals, better fares, and hey, how about this, better service. Right now, my worry is that we're going to have even more consolidation, which will lead to higher fares, which will lead to worse service, which will basically mean the increased meaninglessness of the frequent flyer programs. Because let's face it, if you're filling 87% of your seats, you have no incentive to give away free tickets.
Right.
So I'm worried about that.
Well, and that's something to talk about. I want to come back, and since you brought up the frequent flyer programs, because that is such an amusing story to me, and I'd like to ask you to comment on it. Because back in the 1980s when they were first started, maybe most Americans didn't realize it, but the airline industry went into competition with the U.S. Treasury at that point. They were printing fiat money in the form of these air miles. If you think about it, air miles, if you were a United or an American patron, you could redeem your air miles for tickets. You could redeem them for upgrades. You could buy merchandise. You could get into their clubs. A lot of different ways you could use their air miles just like money. So, which was, you know, interesting and it was exciting. But now, as you said, airline miles have been marginalized because there's no incentive to fill those seats. Why is it, and I want to ask you to look back on this historically, do you foresee the United States government stepping in at any time to try to tax air miles or create them as some form of income so that they can capitalize on this, particularly since the coffers need filling?
Sure. No, the answer to that is an absolute no, and I'll tell you why. 20 years ago, the United States government did try to come in and tax miles. You had a lot of overzealous IRS auditors who were letting people know that they did not declare their free miles as income. And guess what? It never went to tax court. And the reason why it never went to tax court, not a single judge would hear the case because they were members of the mileage program too. So that's a non-issue. That's a non-starter. But it's actually worse than that. See, the airlines are in the best business of all. And the best business is not the airline business. It's the frequent flyer business. The frequent flyer programs of the airlines make more money than the airlines themselves. And the reason why they do that is that the airlines are doing two things simultaneously. They're printing the currency, as you said, but they're also controlling the redemption. Well, if they can keep the redemption under 10%, which they're doing, that's a 90% ROI. The Sopranos don't get that kind of deal. The numbers hold up. Look, the actual valuation, the market evaluation of the American Airlines Frequent Flyer Program is over $6 billion. The actual market capitalization of American Airlines is only $2.5 billion. Now, that ought to tell you something right there. So, and you mentioned merchandise. That's the biggest joke of all, because the airlines realize they've created an entire nation of addicted mileage junkies. We all like to know how many miles we have. Redeeming them, of course, is hopeless. So the airlines realize that they've reached this point of diminishing returns where people are just, you know, why earn miles if you can't use them? What's the point of a loyalty program that doesn't actually reward you for your loyalty? So what the airlines are doing is they're trying to find new and hardly innovative, I would say, ways of redeeming miles for anything other than a flight. Well, if you do the math, it gets even more anger-inducing because they're saying, well, you know, instead of redeeming your miles for a flight, how about a magazine subscription? How about a toaster? How about a box of chocolate? Well, guess what? We did the math. 54% of all airline miles are earned on the ground for people who are not even flying using your Affinity credit cards, and you're getting 1 mile per dollar spent. So that means for a 25,000-mile award ticket, you essentially spent over $14,000 before you ever even used an airplane ticket.
Wow.
Now, let's do the math on that. Assuming they even redeem your miles for that free ticket, you spent $14,000 for it. Well, they're not redeeming them for the tickets now. They're redeeming them for something else like a subscription to a magazine. Well, guess what? You just spent $9,000 for a subscription to Reader's Digest. Are you happy now?
No, not at all.
And it's even worse. Some airlines are letting you say, well, you know what? For 8,000 miles, we'll let you redeem it for a box of Godiva chocolate. Well, it's a 32-ounce box of Godiva chocolates. We did the math. There are 18 pieces of chocolate in that box. You just spent $450 per piece of chocolate. So the bottom line is, they're at an interesting crossroads where they're about to get a lot of people angry with them, because what's the point of inducing me to join when you never deliver the goods?
Nah.
And I think the airlines are coming close to a threshold moment where some very enterprising attorney will file a class action suit and charge the airlines with running what essentially is an illegal, unregulated lottery with their frequent flyer program. So watch this space. Things could happen.
Oh, you heard it here first on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We're talking to Peter Greenberg, the CBS News travel editor, and we're diving into the travel industry in some depth. Now, Peter, one of the things that I'd like you to comment on is very topical, because we're just coming out of the roughest winter season that the East Coast has seen in I don't know how many years. And there were a lot of people that were stuck at airports because flights were being canceled. And the government really had set up a law that it created terrible unintended consequences. Now, you remember a couple of years ago when the law was passed that you can't sit in an airplane for more than 3 hours without some sort of form of punishment on the airlines, and I think it's $2,500 a seat is what they charge.
Actually, no, it's not true. I'll tell you what the deal is.
What is it?
The actual law went into effect. It's a rule from the DOT that went into effect last April that said the following. If you go out from the gate and you're stuck on the tarmac and you don't get back to the gate within 3 hours, the airline would be fined up to $27,500 per passenger. That works out on a 737 to $4.2 million. So the unintended consequences, which I know you were aiming at, really hasn't happened. What the airlines have done is it's forced the airlines to be more sensible in their scheduling and more sensible in terms of how they position their planes, because it's all about taking an airplane and taking it out of sequence or taking it out of cycle. And when you take an airplane out of sequence and out of cycle, it's an exponential problem then in terms of how long it takes for them to get that airplane back into service with the right crew and on the right route. So what you're seeing now, and you talked about the storms a couple of weeks ago, the airlines, the minute they saw how bad the storm was, as opposed to just getting people on the plane and boarding them and sitting them out on the tarmac in the snow, they said, let's just cancel the flight because we know we're not going, and that way we're not going to basically disenfranchise our plane and disenfranchise our crew, so that when the storm is over, we can get back and running at the place where we needed to start from anyway. So I think it's actually had a good effect.
All right. Well, that's interesting, because the ripple effect of that, Peter, though, is that the flight gets canceled and there are people stuck in the airport. There are people stuck in the other airports because of the hub and spoke system that airlines use. And
But a storm is a storm. I'd much rather be canceled either at the terminal or from the comfort of my own home than in seat 18E.
Well, that's a very good point, and that is a valid point, and that's the reason they passed it. And that's why you are the travel guru. We're talking to Peter Greenberg. We're talking to Peter Greenberg, everybody, CBS News travel editor. Peter, I'm going to go back into ancient history, and you and I are both old enough to actually remember when this happened. Back in 1978, the airline industry was deregulated, and the deregulation created all kinds of turmoil and opportunity in the airline industry, for sure. But when the industry was deregulated, you know, the skies above the United States were not truly opened up. Why is it that I cannot take a Lufthansa flight from New York to Detroit? Wouldn't that truly be in kind of an open skies, deregulated environment?
Well, you're talking about federal deregulation versus something called cabotage. Deregulation, I think, was a good thing on a lot of different levels. It also weeded out a lot of inefficient airlines, because deregulation allowed a lot of bad airline management without the umbrella and support of the federal government to show you how really pathetic they could be. However, the bad part of deregulation was it doesn't allow any attorney general in any U.S. state to do good consumer reporting and good consumer regulation. So the airlines get off a lot on stuff that any other business in that state would be indicted for. However, you bring up the idea of flying British Airways from L.A. to New York or Lufthansa between Detroit and Chicago. We're going to get to that point pretty soon, because what we're seeing is the beginning of what we call strategic alliances that are worldwide. You have One World in America, which is American and British and Qantas and Royal Jordanian and many others. You have United with Star Alliance, which is the biggest alliance. And then, of course, you have SkyTeam with Delta and others. And I would predict that within 3 years, we won't be flying branded airlines anymore. We'll be flying those strategic alliances. And once that happens, you will see those floodgates open. And quite frankly, if I had a choice between flying, United Airlines from LA to New York or Qantas, guess what? I'm on Qantas.
You bet. I mean, most people would be. The service is better, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of good reasons for opening that up. I like that. Let me ask you a quick question. This is a real factorial question, but airlines, you know, are there more airlines now in the United States or in China?
Oh, more airlines in China.
Yeah, and that's an unknown fact for many of my listeners. Tell me why.
Because they are now, 30 years later, doing their own form of deregulation and letting the free marketplace rule, and everybody who has enough capitalization, and there's a lot of money rolling around China, is starting an airline with brand new airplanes and well-trained crews. Same thing is happening in India. You know, you take a look at the BRIC countries, which of course is Brazil, Russia, India, and China, and you're seeing in many of those countries an explosion in the number of international and regional airlines.
That's great. We're talking to Peter Greenberg, everybody, CBS News travel editor. And Peter, that brings up another interesting point that many people don't realize about manufacturing in the United States. What is the number one manufactured product in the United States and will be continue to be that worldwide as well?
Boy, you got me.
Airplanes. Boeing is our biggest exporter, and we continue to manufacture those airplanes here in the United States. We continue to sell them to China. We continue to sell them to the BRIC countries. And as a result, it is the mainstay of our manufacturing here in the United States. Many people fail to realize that. Let me ask you about Boeing and Boeing versus Airbus, since we're still on the topic of airlines. You know, who's going to win? Boeing has taken the path of the 787 Dreamliner, which is lighter, composite fabrics, materials, and so forth, and fewer seats. It's about a comparable to a 757, maybe a 767 today. Whereas Airbus has created the behemoth, the A380, I believe it is, which is a double-decker monster, which is in service now on some trans-Pacific flights, but represents a completely different model, which is cram as many people onto an airplane as you possibly can and then go as long a distance as you possibly can, versus Boeing, which is a lighter, more efficient airplane that's more versatile on short haul and long haul. Who's going to win in the long run, do you think?
Nobody, and I'll tell you why. Because you have a Boeing situation where they could have won had they gotten their subcontractors together and made prompt deliveries on a 787, which was supposed to be delivered almost 2.5 years ago and is still being delayed. It's also a brave new world airplane being composed of, as you know, composite materials, and that has to be tested, and tested on a completely different metric. The A380 that you talk about is a plane that was also delayed in its development and never made the deliveries on time and is limited by its very size as to where it can fly. And I happen to believe, and maybe I'm wrong, that within 5 years, those planes will be freighters. Because we've gone from the joy of travel to the ordeal of human transportation. And the A380, depending on who's configuring it, you know, Lufthansa and Qantas will certainly configure their A380s different than some of the Asian airlines when you're talking about, you know, certified an airplane that can hold 853 people. Do you really want to be in baggage claim waiting for your bags to come off that mother?
No.
Not me. So I really believe that the A380 performs remarkably well as a freighter. And let us not forget that the first two launch customers of the A380 were FedEx and UPS, but because they were so delayed delivering the plane, they canceled their orders. Well, you're seeing a number of other airlines now on the verge of canceling their orders for the 787 because Boeing is so late in delivering that. So right now, I don't know who's going to win the game. Right now, it's a question of who can lose it longer.
Sounds like a race to the bottom to me. We're talking to Peter Greenberg, CBS News travel editor. Peter, we've only got about a minute left, but I'm going to completely change subjects away from airlines to eco-travel, which is something that you write about. You're very familiar with this. Eco-travel is emerging as the latest trend in travel. What is eco-travel, real quickly, in about 30 seconds?
Eco-travel is the most misleading word in the world. It's misused by a lot of travel people, and we don't have enough time in 30 seconds to let people know that somebody just says they're eco-tourism or they're eco-friendly. It may only mean they're performing to municipal code. They're not doing anything brilliant. You need to ask questions every time you travel. What are you doing that's outside the municipal code that really makes a difference? If they can't answer that question, this has nothing to do with ecotourism.
That's great. Peter, we've been talking to Peter Greenberg, everybody. Thank you so much for being our special guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.
You got it.
Take care.